7:08 in the morning. You were listening to Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks.
And I'm Brian Edwards-Teeger. Good morning, Kat Brooks.
New haircut and shave there, Brian?
I had a little time free yesterday, yeah. Spent some quality time with the lawnmower.
All right. You can tell it's early, folks. I want to start off just by acknowledging the fact that our Congresswoman Barbara Lee held a vigil in Oscar Grant Plaza last night. I did not go. Mm. I am preparing my house for a very important visit this afternoon. But over 200 people did go, and the city council member spoke. Lisa Garza was there, John Jones III, who we've had on the show, who's an Oakland native and formerly incarcerated, up-and-coming leader in the city of Oakland, spoke. George Galvis was there. It was a wide, broad swath of representatives of the Oakland community. The hashtag Not One More also partnered with labor. So the head of the Alameda Labor Council.
I believe you.
Woo! Liz Ortega was there. National Union of Health Co-workers invited folks to come out. It was nice.
Yeah. Dumb question.
Nice. Yes.
What does the hashtag mean?
Hashtag not one more. Mm-hmm. That's not a dumb question. Not one more shooting. Not one more victim. Not one more mass shooting. Not one more lost life. Not one more.
So something we had hoped to cover this morning but weren't able to schedule a guest for, what San Jose is thinking of doing at the city level, which no city or any level of government has done so far in the United States, but it's an idea that's been kind of floating in gun policy circles for a while. Mayor Sam Liccardo has proposed a new
San Jose,
rule.
Right?
This is San Jose, 10th largest city in the country, requiring all gun owners to be insured. Or if they do not purchase insurance, to pay into a fund operated by the city that would cover liability from their guns.
And what does that mean exactly?
This is a really good question. And the proposed rule has not been published yet. So there are obvious situations where it would be good to have liability insurance for a gun. A lot of guns are involved in accidents and fatal accidents. People leave their guns unsecured. Kids get the guns. Good things do not happen next. Or guns get stolen, used to commit crimes. If the owner was negligent in leaving the gun someplace, you know.
You mean like police do when they leave their cars unlocked and guns in the seats?
Yeah. You may have heard about a case in San Francisco. There are theories under which liability could extend to the gun owner. So, you know, one effect it would have is it creates a pool of money in the pockets of the insurance company that can pay victims if the owner of the gun does not have the money to pay them themselves. Now, there is something else that the NRA has experimented with to not great effect, which is insuring gun owners for shooting other people.
Did Dick Cheney use that?
The NRA had to lard this up with all kinds of qualifications. It could only be in self-defense, and you would only get the payout after you, at your own expense, mounted a successful legal defense against any charges of murder or manslaughter or assault. And if you, at your own expense, got yourself declared not guilty in court, then the NRA would pay your costs. This was dubbed murder insurance, partly because of how they were marketing it, and obviously creates perverse incentives because you don't want people who own guns to not fear facing legal consequences for misusing them. But I think the overall idea as a policy is that, A, there should be some cost towards gun ownership. Everybody has to get liability insurance if they want to drive a car around, right? There should be some pool of money to cover victims of gun crimes when the actual person responsible doesn't have the money to make them whole. And if you get the insurance companies involved, then they might start slapping conditions on policies, like you have to have a gun safe in the house. You have to take a gun safety training course. You can't just pick up that semi-automatic handgun at Walmart, take it home, and think, I've seen a lot of action movies, I know how to use it. So that's kind of an interesting idea. It seems like it's nibbling around the edges of the problem everyone's thinking about, which is mass shootings. The Gilroy shooter had a semi-automatic rifle with a 75-round cartridge that would not be legal was not legal when he brought it into the state of California. He purchased it in Nevada. So obviously an insurance regime wouldn't have changed anything about that situation. But it is something, and I think people are looking for something.
Yeah, I mean, it is something, and as someone who believes in gun ownership, I do think actually liability insurance is a good idea. I also think that gun owners should be responsible. And I mean, you do have to take a test. It's not a hands-on test, but you do have to read a book and you do have to take a test. And a big part of that test is gun safety and how to lock up your gun, you know, like what the laws are and what you're supposed to do. So in theory, you know all this before you're able to purchase the gun. And I do think that gun owners should be responsible, you know, if their own negligence results in harm. I told you the story to your horror the other day in the office about the first time I shot myself. Well, the only time I've shot myself.
Why don't you tell it to everyone?
So I was, I think like 7 or 8. Uh-huh. And I was with a friend of my mother's and we were supposed to be going fishing. We used to have a cabin up in Utah and we were supposed to be going fishing. It was just a 2-hour drive from Vegas. And she had a company over, so she was in her living room, and I was in her bedroom. And I'll never forget, I was watching Dallas, of all of the god-awful shows, and how appropriate, right? And it was a silver, I still remember, it was a small little hand pistol with, like, a bone-colored handle.
Wait. Pearl?
Yeah.
Mother of Pearl?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a toy. Now, my mother, now, this is also a really important piece of the story. Like, I was forbidden to have any toy guns, be around toy guns, play with toy guns. Mm-hmm. So when I saw this, I was, you know, fascinated, and I also assumed it was a toy. So I picked it up, and I cocked back the trigger, and then the next thing I heard was this loud, like, screaming, screeching sound in my ear, and everything just sort of went into slow motion, and she came running in. I shot myself, you all can't see, but in my index finger, in the bottom of my index finger, the bullet came out the top of my finger. I remember her dog following me around, licking the blood up as I walked around. And the next thing I remember being in the hospital and my mother physically assaulting the doctor because they were bringing me pain medication. I still can't close the finger all of the way. I will always have the scar. And I still have a couple of bullet fragments in my finger. So, yes, that person should have been responsible for what happened. She should have had to pay my mom's medical bills, you know, whatever else. And I was too young to have any idea what happened, except for they weren't friends anymore after that. But
yeah, no kidding. And if you had been playing with another kid, right?
Could have shot the kid. I could have killed myself. I mean, that's what's real, right? Like I, by the grace of God.
It wasn't pointed that direction.
It wasn't pointed that direction, you know, that I was holding it like, you know, whatever. But negligence happens and gun owners should absolutely be responsible. Where I was going, I was like, I don't know where, how this gets to this issue of mass shootings and preventing mass shootings, you know, like you mentioned. I do think that people are looking to do something, anything in this moment to feel like we're moving towards some sort of accountability with gun ownership, which feels very unaccountable in this country. It just sort of feels like you want a gun, you can have a gun, and, you know, it's sort of a free-for-all.
Yeah, you want a car, you got to get a license and insurance.
Right.
Registration.
Right. and guns, too, are deadly, you know, can be deadly weapons. But so I think it's a good law. They're also considering it in something similar in Massachusetts and New York. I brought up the issue of the police sort of facetiously, but not really, because the what he's proposing does explicitly say that it would not apply law enforcement officers. And it's a conversation that cities, including, you know, my city, Oakland, we've been having for quite, well, activists have been having for quite some time. You know, part of the fallout, I mean, of course, the most important fallout are the lives that get lost. But the other part of the fallout when police shoot and kill people is that taxpayers end up paying those settlements. So when you hear that people get $1.5 million settlements or, you know, be more than that, it's not, oh, the police department is coming out of $1.5 million of its 47% of the general fund budget. Yeah, it's taxpayers.
Certainly not officer-friendly paying out of his own pocket.
No, right. Not out of that big pension that they have. Mm-hmm. None of that. Our roads are paying for it. Our mental health programs, or lack thereof, are paying for it. And so it is something that I think that should also apply to law enforcement officers. If you get found, you know, accountable for killing somebody, and you should not have killed them, which is most cases, why are we paying for that?
Yeah.
Why are you not liable? And maybe that would curb some of their behavior too.
And police lose track of a shockingly large number of guns.
I mean, you mentioned the case in San Francisco, but I've seen at least 6 since then.
Right. I think Thomas P. Peel, investigative reporter at the East Bay Times. He's with Bay Area News Group. We had him on a couple of years ago. He started doing Public Records Act requests of like every police agency he could hit up in the Bay Area and compiling a database of every gun they lost track of, right? A lot of which were guns that officers had stolen or kind of took home and they didn't keep track of anymore. And it was more than 900.
Right. The chief of San Luis Obispo recently left her gun in the bathroom of an El Pollo Loco. Now, they had video surveillance of the man who took it and they were able to track him down. But come on now.
Yeah.
You went and had lunch and just left your gun in the toilet? In a potty? And guns are heavy, y'all. Like, for people who don't care. Like, you, I can't understand how you don't notice.
Uh-huh.
That weight is not on your hip until you get all the way back to the office.
Why are you taking it into the stall in the first place?
Because it's on her hip. That part I understand. You know, it's on her hip.
Oh, I got it.
She takes it off.
You
want
to
right,
get clear.
Because she's got to,
yeah.
You know, I'm not going to go into the lady's business. Mm-hmm. But you know what I mean? Like, that part makes sense. What doesn't make sense is this thing that's supposed to be a part of your uniform and a part of, really, you know, your extended person mm-hmm. that weighs however many pounds. You got back to the office, you'd be like, whoopsie, it's in the potty. Anyway.
So we'll see. We'll see. Congress is certainly not coming back from its recess to have the Senate consider any kind of gun control legislation. But there is some amount of talking between Senate Democrats and the Trump administration about doing something at the federal level. I think the biggest beneficiaries would be states like, California that already have strict state gun laws, but where the biggest threat is guns coming in from out of state.
Because of the loopholes. And that's the conversation you and I have repeatedly mm-hmm. where I like want to bang my head into the wall.
Yeah.
Right. It's the loopholes that need to be addressed. And those first, you know, those are the things that the NRA and gun rights, you know, maniacs, you know, fight the most. Like you can have a California address and order a gun in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Or you can go to Las Vegas, Nevada with a California address, I'm using air quotes, and get a gun. I mean, there's like, or the gun shows, right? You can go and buy a gun and walk out the door, depending on what state you're in. Those are all loopholes. And then you drive it into California. So, like, those are the things that need to be figured out, how we close those things.
All right. While you were closing those things, let me ask you another question.
Mm-hmm.
So yesterday we had this lawyer, Chip Gibbons, on, making the case that the calls circulating on cable news to create a domestic terrorism law that would let the FBI go after white supremacist groups the way the CIA goes after jihadist groups would be a good thing. The guest was rebutting that. And in the course of making their argument, kind of nodded to their existing and abolitionist line of thought that even with white supremacist mass shooters, we shouldn't look to police and prisons as a solution. And the conversation stopped when I kind of said, well, what's the alternative when you have Nazi targeting Latinos in the street with a weapon of war? And you spend a lot more time in these circles than I do, but we got to that point in the conversation with about 45 seconds left on the clock.
Right. And then, you know, in fairness to Chip Gibbons, they were like, that wasn't the point of my article. But I felt pretty strongly that that was a pretty big bomb to drop and not follow the threats where that leads. And what I, you know, we talked about it in the office afterwards, and I have not heard that from, I'm like not an abolitionist purist. I think I'm gonna start calling myself an abolitionist in training. Because I haven't gotten all the way there yet. And folks know, because I say it often, you know, I don't know what to do with people that do horrible things to children. I don't know how you really interrupt other than investing in resource people that are, you know, committed to utilizing violence, extreme violence to generate profit. I don't know. I don't know. And mm-hmm. and the answer that a restorative justice circle is the answer, like, that doesn't fly with me. And I don't know what you do with Nazis with guns mm-hmm. either. You know, we were talking about that one of the difficult, more difficult questions that struggle with in the circles that I run in is this call to jail killer cops, which is often the first call of families, right? That because that's the only vehicle of justice that they have. Right. There's not any other options. Most, you know, there's no other pathways. There's no opportunities for there to be any type of restoration. And so that's what they call for. And as people that support families that have lost loved ones to state violence, it's our jobs to support loved ones who have lost love to support families, lost ones y'all forgive me, who have lost loved ones to state violence for that call. And, but we work with these families over a period of time and introduce abolitionist ideology to them, right? And eventually the conversation comes, you know, if officer so-and-so is sitting in prison, how does that make you any more whole? Mm-hmm. And more often than not, after a certain period of time, the families are like, nah, right? I'm actually not more whole. I'm more concerned, and this is a point that you made yesterday, Brian, when we were talking about this, they're more concerned that officer so-and-so is back on the street with a gun and has the ability to kill another family. And in fact, that's what the data show, right? Mm-hmm. That cops that have killed before will kill again. Cops that have killed now have usually killed before. So that's a very long-winded way to say, I don't have the answers either. And I call myself an abolitionist in training because that's not a conversation I can have mm-hmm. about the dude who went to El Paso and murdered all of those people. I can't have, I'm glad Dylann Roof, mm-hmm. right, who murdered the people in the church, I'm glad he's sitting in prison. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you would do with those people. I don't know, as a black woman, where I'm supposed to find a restorative justice space for someone who wants to kill me because I am a black woman. Mm-hmm. My job is to defend myself and defend my community. And by any means necessary, and one of those means right now in the system that we have is incarceration. Mm-hmm. Because they're not sick, they're evil. And I want to get that straight too. This is not a mental illness. Uh-huh. These are people that hate deeply based on, you know, racism, which is the foundation of this country's founding.
Yeah. I guess the bigger question and like the premise of that interview is, okay, it's kind of like an empirical fact that federal law enforcement does not direct a fraction of the resources to surveilling, disrupting, and deterring violent white supremacist groups that it does to other less threatening sectors of our society.
Like Black Lives Matter.
Right. Would it be a good thing if that ratio flipped, if the FBI was using the tools it has used to target activist groups against actual domestic terrorists?
See, that's like if we lived in a world where that wasn't dominated by racism, mm-hmm. yes, I think that would be a good thing. I agreed with the premise of Chip Gibbons' article, and I posted it on my page with the hashtag, the FBI is not your friend. Mm-hmm. The FBI has never been a friend to people of color, has never been a friend to leftist organizing or organizers in this country, and in fact has been the enemy, right? We look at what the FBI did to the Black Panther Party, the number of people that are still sitting in prison for doing little more than demanding an end to the war on black, brown, or indigenous life. So the thought of expanding their powers that already go wildly unchecked is terrifying, because they're not going to expand those powers and use them to track, pursue, interrupt white domestic terrorists. Mm-hmm. They're going to, just like the more recent things that got leaked, they consider black identity extremists a bigger threat than white nationalist violence. But I don't see any people, I don't see black people walking into Walmarts with machine guns or military grade weapons mm-hmm. and killing people. So I agree with the premise of the article. It feels like a lose-lose. Mm-hmm. What needs to happen is we need to get to the root causes of the issue, which is white supremacy, right? That's the answer, and that's a long-term answer, but that's the solution.
You gotta do the right thing.
Do the right thing. Are we moving on? Do the right thing. So Do the Right Thing is the next KPFA matinee, and it is happening on August 25th at 474 24th Street, Oakland. And I was telling Brian that when I was 14, I was in my godmother's, like a B-list actress in Hollywood. And so when I was a kid, I used to love to go see her. And she and her husband at the time took me to go see Do the Right Thing in this like private screening thing. And then we went to what used to be a fancy or fun restaurant in L.A. called Ed DeBevick's. It's closed now, but the waiters were dressed. Anyway, so we're in Ed DeBevick's. All the waiters and waitresses are dressed in these 1950s costumes, roller skating around the restaurant. Even at 14, I had an opinion, and I had a political analysis because my mother was amazing and made sure I had one. So I start talking about racism, and specifically, we're talking about Radio Raheem, right, and his mm-hmm. right to have the boombox and the problems with the Italians being in the black neighborhood and da 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 da. My godfather, I'm 14, y'all. My godfather stands up in Ed DeBevick. He gets so angry. He stands up in Ed DeBevick's and starts screaming bloody murder, like towering over me and screaming in my face about how I didn't know what I was talking about. And this was the problem, is black people just couldn't let racism go. And that was in the past. It was the craziest experience I've ever had. One of the craziest experiences I've ever had in my life. But one of those experiences with white men. Mm-hmm. That, like, all he did was push me further to the left, right? Mm-hmm. Like, thanks, Bill. I am indeed that radical black person that you were screaming at me about being at 14.
What? I will never experience being a black girl in America.
Not this lifetime, maybe next one.
I'm having a hard time imagining what anyone could have found so threatening about the political opinion of a 14-year-old that merited standing up and screaming in a restaurant.
I guess he didn't like the mirror being reflected back at him, you know, his own racial issues. And that movie was hard for a lot of white people, right? It was. It caused a lot. It created a lot of conversations about race. But the best thing was all of the people dressed up in their 1950s outfits that stopped mid skate, right? They're on their skates and they've got their food and they're staring at the table.
We're wearing costumes that evoke warm memories of segregation in America.
And then I said, and my godmother, the B-list actress who is known when she goes out, is like hiding, her face. Anyway, come watch Do the Right Thing with us. I think I'm going to bring Jaden and watch it with her for the first time and go out to dinner with her and not scream at her.
I never seen it in a theater with people.
Oh, yeah.
Saw it in VHS.
Yeah. Should be a good time. Should elicit some good conversation.
I never saw, like, fights break out over it.
Yeah. Lots of fights. Yeah. Lots of fights. But that's Spike Lee.
There you go.